a Mormon, a member of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, a religion founded in the U.S. in 1830 by Joseph Smith, Jr. A Christian, a person who has received Christian baptism or is a believer in Christianity. A Satanist, the worship of Satan, typically involving a travesty of Christian symbols and practices, such as placing a cross upside down. A story I will share with you this Tuesday. There is something very scary about a serial killer. When killers are caught and their picture is released, you can almost see the hate or the loss or the nothing behind their eyes. Some killers live double lives. Some are just straight crazy psychopaths. But every once in a while, someone comes along that you would least expect. One that doesn't have a distinct motive. One that doesn't go for women or long hair or men or kids. This one has no motive at all, except timing. Right place, right time. Or for the victims, wrong place and wrong time. This is the story of Israel Keyes.
Tuesdays with Trisha, Season 2, Episode 4.
Welcome to Anchorage, Alaska, for this week's episode. If you are a first-time listener, I say welcome to the coolest place on earth. And if you are a repeat basic bitch, my heart is with you and welcome back. So I gotta just say, I love Alaska. Well, I've never been to Alaska, but it's definitely on my bucket place of, but no, definitely on my bucket list of places to go. But my cousin currently resides out there, so shout out to Kyle. I love you and miss you lots. So not only is Alaska known for their awesome fishing and outdoor scenery, Alaska is truly a place of its own. Most locals refer to the other states as the lower 48. And did you know that a gallon of milk costs like $11 there? So it's expensive because of the import-export. But regardless, this place has so much beauty to it. But it is no exception to any roaming serial killers. And in this week's episode, that is exactly the case. Israel Keyes was born on January 7, 1978, in Cove, Utah, to Heidi and John Jeffrey Keyes. They were a large Mormon family, as Israel was one of 10 kids. Now, somewhere after the age of 3, the family deconverted from the Mormon religion, and instead they became like radical Christians, kind of described more as a militant militia type of church with a bit of like Amish thrown in there. Now, around this time, the family decided to move from Utah to Coville, Washington, where it is said that the family was living in a one-room house with no electricity or running water. The family also, around this time, made good friends with a neighbor by the name of Chevy Kehoe. Now, for my really basic murderous bitches, you should probably know who this is. But for my people who have no idea in the world who Chevy Kehoe is, he was convicted of murdering a family in 1996. So, not exactly an ideal neighbor. Israel and his siblings were all homeschooled, and in his teen years, Israel decided to renounce the Christian faith and focus more on Satanism. Now, as he took on this newfound faith, Israel decided that this would be a good time to join the army. Oh, fuck my life. So, Israel served in the U.S. Army from 1998 to 2001 at Fort Lewis, which is in Texas, Fort Hood, that's in Washington, and it looks like he had a tour in Egypt. So he did the usual 4-year stint, and actually, by the time he left, was a specialist. He was awarded an Army Achievement Medal, Army Service Ribbon, Marksman Badge with a Rifle Bar, Expert Infantry Badge, and Air Assault Badge. So basically, it looks like when he got out of the Army, he knew how to shoot a gun, and very well, in fact. Now, reports I have read from his days back in the Army let us know that he had a pretty quiet demeanor and he typically kept to himself. It was also said that on weekends that he liked to let loose and he did drink very heavily, so he would actually drink entire bottles of his favorite bourbon called Wild Turkey. And he was actually a huge fan of Insane Clown Posse. Now, if you've never heard of them, they are a death rap band out of Michigan, and they paint their faces like clowns, and they have a lot of explicit lyrics. Like, for example, yeah, I'm about to okay, here we go. I'm scary like Michael Jackson up close. I'm digging up dead bodies. Look at me, I'm gross. My name's Violent J, but you can call me syphilis, gonorrhea, the clap, because I infected this rap. You want to know if I could ever kill somebody? Well, that's like asking Charlie Manson if he's ever been in jail. I kill family, friends, myself. Well, yeah, I'd kill myself if I could only survive. Okay, that was probably really horrible, but that just gives you a little bit about what type of music he was listening to. And I'm not a firm believer in blaming music because for anything, but just the mindset it gives you. Now, Israel eventually did leave the army and he moved back to his hometown in Washington, where he met a woman in the Makah tribe. It's common, I think, for Washington to have, because everywhere has reservations up there, or I know some places do. So he spent time with her for a while, and eventually the couple had a daughter together. In 2007, Israel moved to Anchorage, Alaska, and began his own construction business called Keys Construction and worked as a handyman, construction worker, and contractor. I do believe at this time his girlfriend and daughter had moved there and lived with him during all of this time. And it also looked like he traveled a lot for work as well. So lots of reports of him being in different states throughout the years. And it seems like he led a pretty normal life up to this point, or so we are all to believe.
That's right. It's CBD Store, located on 31801 Mission Trail in Lake Elsinore, California. This is Inland Empire's only premium CBD store. You guys, seriously, they have CBD infused water, oils, tinctures, gummies, roll-ons, bath bombs, scrubs, lotions, so much more. You have to go check it out for your one-stop CBD shop. It's CBD Store in Lake Elsinore, California.
Now, in our story, this brings me to February 1st, 2012, in Anchorage, Alaska, to Common Grounds Coffee Shop. It's past closing time, and the boyfriend of 18-year-old barista worker Samantha Cohen came to pick up his girlfriend after work. When he arrived, he noticed that no one was there and the lights were all off, which he found super odd. And he kind of looked around for Samantha and didn't see anyone, but he was supposed to pick her up. So where was she? He immediately rushed and told Samantha's parents, who in turn called the police to report their missing daughter and also the owner of the coffee shop. The owner of the coffee shop didn't know what had happened to his worker, but definitely knew that they had surveillance tapes. And when they finally got a chance to take a look at these surveillance tapes, this is where this story takes a real bone-chilling turn. Now, I've actually watched the surveillance video myself. You can find it on YouTube. Just Google it on in. It's about a 12-minute video, and for the first minute, we see that Samantha's in like this small little coffee shop. It's the one of the coffee shops like you would walk up to, or maybe even drive up to, but most likely you'd park a car and drive up to this little coffee stand. And it's where it's only enough to where only like one worker would be working at a time. So in the video, you can see her kind of like cleaning up in the video, doing different things. And I want to also tell you guys that this video has four different camera angles in it. So there's four different frames that you're watching during this 12-minute period. Now, around the 2-minute mark, you see Samantha look over her shoulder as if somebody is asking her a question or like, you know, somebody says something to her. And I want to mention also, too, that when I watched it back again, I did look at the outside camera. And before this 2-minute mark we get in this video, you do see somebody walking. He's in all black and the person is approaching, you know, and so you see him kind of like approach the coffee shop, but you don't see him directly walk right up to like the stand window. He kind of goes out of frame. And then that's when you notice you don't see him again in the frame until you notice Samantha's head turning around. She turns around and like says, whoever says something to her, she turns back around to grab a coffee and then turns back around. And then that's when you see that she actually puts her hands up in like a freeze position. And then after that, you start to see her turn off the lights. So she looks like she's like taking direction from somebody. All you can see is a black figure. You can't really tell what type of person it is. You just know it's somebody. After the lights go off, you see her going to the register and grabbing cash and handing it to the person on the other side. And then eventually she sits down in the shop in the video. Now she sits down like where the person would be at the window. She sits down kind of right in front of that area. And I noticed that when she does sit down in that area on the outside camera frame, there's actually a car that pulls out of the parking spot that they were in. Because mind you guys, there's cars parked all in this area that you can see. The person pulls out of the parking spot and then, you know, stops actually almost about like 200 feet from the front of the coffee shop. This person gets out, opens the back trunk, is doing something for a few minutes, then sadly gets back in the car and drives off, not noticing a thing at this point. At this point in the video, you then see the person climb over the opening of the coffee shop and enter it. Now this person is in the shop with Samantha. It's dark, so it's actually hard to see what the person is doing, but they're standing over Samantha for a little bit of time. And then after that, eventually the person, like you can see, pulls her up, kind of like stands her up, and they walk through the shop and out of the frame. And about like a minute or two later, they come to the video again on the outside frame, and they're seen walking towards a vehicle, and then you don't see them again. So obviously after police and Samantha sees this video, they know now that she has been kidnapped and are in a panic to find her. But they don't find anything else that helps them in the video. So it ends up, you know, the investigators doing them things, their thing as they wait, you know. And by February 17th, 2012, Samantha's boyfriend receives a text message from Samantha's phone, actually. And the text says, under Albert in Connor Boggs Park. So police quickly put this together. They realize that this is like a statue in this park, which is called Connor Boggs. So they go to this location and they actually find a ransom note that is in like a Ziploc bag. And attached to the note is a newspaper clipping from February 13th. So I think like 4 days prior. And a picture of Samantha, who looks to be tied up and posing, and a demand for $30,000 to be deposited in Samantha's bank account for Samantha's safe return. So it looks like quickly the FBI and the family of Samantha Coing get this money together and they deposit it into this bank account. Samantha's bank was told to notify the police if any transactions happened through this account. They were supposed to be notified immediately. And on February 25th, there happens to be a hit on Samantha's account for $500, the daily limit, and it's actually in Anchorage, Alaska. And so, gosh, I wish it was like a movie and the police were able to like pull up and there was this arrest and Samantha was found, but that's sadly not the case. Even though the bank did notify the police in, you know, a good amount of time, it still takes time for everything. And it also takes what, a total of maybe like a minute, minute and a half to do a transaction from the bank to pull out the money. So that's how people get robbed easily as well. So even though they did that, unfortunately, they were too late. And then on March 7th, they get another hit for $400, but this time it's in Wilcox, Arizona. So it's nowhere near Alaska or where they think Samantha may be. Then in Lordsburg, New Mexico, another $80 is taken out. A couple days later, $480 in Humble, Texas. And on March 11th, another $480 in Shepherd, Texas. So at this point, the perpetrator had stopped at so many ATMs along the way that they actually were able to get a description of the person that was driving the vehicle. And it looks like that an APB ends up going out for a white Ford Focus. And thankfully, the Texas sheriff was on duty and happened to be listening to the morning APB news because he happened to be along his route that day. And what do you know? He comes across a white Ford Focus. Now, sorry, had to take a drink of water right now. My voice is about to go out. All right. So anyways, this brings us to March 13th, okay? It's in Lufkin, Texas. I think I said that right. And the Texas officer happened to actually just follow the white Ford Focus for a little bit, trying to figure out, you know, what he can do. Fortunately, this white Ford Focus decided to make a few traffic infractions that gave the sheriff enough time to actually pull the car over. And when the officer asked the man in the vehicle to hand over his license, this license happened to be an Alaska driver's license. And the man's name was Israel Keys. Upon searching the vehicle of Israel, they found rolled up cash, a gray shirt cut up into like a face mask, Samantha Coing's debit card, ID, and cell phone. He was arrested and police knew they had their guy. He was extradited to Alaska for charges. So the crazy thing about Israel Keys, and the thing that makes him the most bone-chilling about this, even though there are other serial killers out there that have by far, I guess, exceeded how many people they killed. But was the fact that Israel really had no MO. He had no motive in a lot of these cases, except for the fact that it was done by pure convenience. So it is said that Israel was very resistant at first to talking to police, because the one thing that seemed to bother Israel the most was the life of his young daughter, ironically. I'm sure a lot of you are thinking, like, what? That doesn't make any sense. But the crazy thing about this man is he did care. He wanted to protect his daughter and basically not have his daughter be able to Google him later on in life and have this, like, hanging over her head. So in exchange for his confessions, he wanted the cops to keep this, like, tight-lipped. But he knew that was never really going to happen. And the thing that makes him crazy is the fact that he did live this double life. You know, he could be the dad, like, down the street, or the dad or the boyfriend at the soccer park or the neighborhood barbecue. And in fact, he's this cold-blooded killer the whole time. And the crazy thing is when Israel decided to kill, it didn't matter who you were, just if the fact that it was convenient enough for him to do so. So Israel did eventually admit to killing Samantha Cohen to police. He said that he had tied her up in the coffee shop and exited the coffee shop that night, and that she actually broke free from him, but we didn't see that on camera. And eventually he, like, tackled her and took her to his vehicle. He kind of got Samantha to calm down and, like, tell her that he wasn't going to kill her. He was just trying to get ransom money. And she, you know, tried. She begged and pleaded, you know, that her family didn't have this type of money. He's got the wrong type of person. But it seems in the end that he convinced her enough to not put up too big of a fight, which I'm sure she did in every sort of way. But sadly, you know, Samantha probably tried to believe him at some point, but that was never his intention at all. By day two, he had sexually assaulted Samantha and strangled her to death in the shed he had hidden her in. He actually had to go meet his family and go on a family cruise that they had already had planned. So he killed her and left her and decided to just leave her for 4 days. And when he got back, the weather in Alaska had actually been so cold that her body had frozen. So it kind of still left her completely intact. And that's when he decided to take the pictures of her and do the whole ransom thing. So really the picture that you see of her is her with her eyes sewn open and placed. She's actually not alive in that photo. And there's even more crazy shit to this story that makes it even just, oh my God, so much more, oh, gives me the heebie-jeebies. So he didn't actually have her cell phone or debit card at the time he abducted her. So if any of you are wondering, like, well, how the hell did he get her PIN number? How did he figure out how to text the boyfriend? Okay, well, actually, the cell phone was at the coffee shop, so he had to go back to the coffee shop to get the cell phone, which he did. He ended up doing it that very night. He admitted to doing that. So they missed that. And then the debit card, you guys are not gonna believe this when I say this. The debit card was inside the boyfriend's fucking truck. Yes, the boyfriend's truck. Okay, so that means that Israel had to sneak over to the boyfriend's house, which he did, and he broke into the boyfriend's truck. And it said that when they talked about it later with the boyfriend, that the boyfriend did remember some guy trying to break into his truck, but he actually didn't catch him in time. And that was the guy that had Samantha. So police do believe that during that time that Samantha was still alive. And that's how he, like, got her cell phone and all of that stuff. And the debit card and everything. So fucking crazy. I don't know about you, but I like tripped on that really hard when I read that. So, and then for the boyfriend or the family to hear that later on, oh my gosh, it's awful. So, it said too that Israel said that he cut up Samantha's body and actually dumped it in a lake nearby that was actually once frozen over. So there's a lot of like ice fishing going on in the Alaskan area. And if you've never ice fished, go watch the movie Grumpy Old Men because they do it in it. But you get like this little like house that's like on the lake, and then you like cut a hole into the ground and you fish for ice. Well, he did that, but that time he, you know, cut up her body and then eventually dumped her body through little holes in the ice house. And then after he got rid of her body, that's when he began his journey through the states on the ransom money. I don't really know what the wife was doing at this time or how much she knew or what she thought he was doing. I would assume that she probably thought he was working. So again, like I said, Israel was not a very talkative guy to police. It took a lot for the police to unfold the things he had done. He had admitted to killing a couple in Essex, Vermont, Bill and Lorraine Currier. He said that he broke into their home, tied them up. He shot Bill in the head and then sexually assaulted Lorraine and then strangled and killed her. But their bodies were actually never found, so they only have to go on the story that Israel talked about. Another really disturbing, sick thing about Israel Keyes was that he was kind of like a huge planner of stuff like this. So sometimes, basically, he planned to kill like months in advance. And not like who, he would actually hide what he called kill buckets, as he called them, and he would fill this bucket. It was like a painter's bucket filled with like kill items, like a rope and a knife and like a gun and probably some chloroform or some rags or whatever you use to kill people. And then he would bury these buckets in like different areas of like the United States, I guess, places that he would visit. And so then, like, he would come back to where these buckets would be buried, and if it was convenient, then that's when he would decide to use it. And that's exactly what happened in the case for the couple. He had buried a kill bucket, like, a few years back, like, a few miles from the Currier home. So he just happened to notice that they were home when he was walking by. So that's kind of like how he picked them. And he also admitted to police that they would have a really hard time ever connecting him to murders that he committed. He was very smart about it all, and he used cash, and he would like fly into Chicago, but then drive to Vermont and kill there, like as if he did in the Currier case. And also, he was like a huge thief on top of it. So police suspect that he had actually was responsible for like 30 home invasions and robberies in different areas. They could never really completely hook him on the murder thing, except for the Cohen case. And FBI also suspect that there are more kill buckets that are actually buried around, but they just haven't been found yet. On December 2nd, 2012, Israel Keyes died while being held in an Anchorage correctional complex of wrist cuts and strangulation. Somebody wasn't watching that guy, or they were paid off. Anyways, A suicide note was found with an ode to murder, but nothing else as far as like any more victims or confessions. The police did find 11 skulls and one pentagram drawn in blood underneath his jail bed, and they have suspected that could have meant the 11 victims. So maybe he remembered how many people he killed after all. I guess in the end, we all will never really know how many people Israel Keyes killed unless they're able to ever connect this with DNA. We don't know in the future if anyone will ever find these so-called kill buckets, or even if there's any kill buckets around to begin with. It could just be hype that Israel said to throw off police. So don't forget that. And don't go finding the buckets either. Get a job. Do something useful. We will never know anything further anymore, probably, about the case and what the police have uncovered, because Israel is no longer with us. A huge condolence to the family and victims of Israel Keyes, and to actually all the John and Jane Does that were victims of Israel that we don't even know about. May eventually they find peace, or may some investigator or somebody find something. You know, Israel Keyes was pretty friggin' scary, you guys, when I read about him and then heard the story. And I just wanted to talk about him because it was just always, you know, everybody always kind of had their own special little thing as far as serial killers, you know, especially the big ones that we're focusing on this season. And so this Israel Keyes, when he really came around, I just felt like, man, I think everybody needs to know about this guy because just of the way he would kill, the carelessness, and like what made this guy like this. So I hope you all enjoyed this week's episode. Feel free to shoot me a DM and tell me what you think. Give me your opinion on Israel and what you think about this. And did this scare you as much as it scared me? Because I think too, are we ever going to have an Israel Keyes copycat or somebody that's just like it? It's crazy. Maybe we do already. Maybe there's other stories are out there for me to share. Sure there will be, unfortunately. To all the victims, again, my condolences, prayers, and love go out to you all. Till next time, see you next week on Tuesdays with Trisha.
Now don't forget to listen to Tuesdays with Trisha, and also make sure you wash your hands and keep your mask on, although it's 2021. And remember, check out Tuesdays with Trisha on Instagram.
And we love our five-star Apple reviews.
Yay!